Hello, cinephiles, and welcome to Indie Outlook, the show that sheds light on must-see cinema from the Windy City and around the globe. I'm your host, Matt Fagerholm of HollywoodChicago.com. Today I'm joined by Mr. Patrick McDonald from HollywoodChicago.com, my colleague at HollywoodChicago.com.
Hello, Matt.
And we've just been talking about this for a while. We are such Hitchcock fans.
Yes.
Like most critics, we just think he is one of the greats. And he, of course he is. He's also one of the most prolific. He has also some of the most, if you just want to count the number of great films he's made more great films than most people.
Yes.
And I'm just so interested now that it just happens to be this year.
Yes,
that people are starting to say there's a weird thing in the atmosphere. 2012 is like the year of Hitchcock, where he's coming back with doing all the Blu-ray releases of his work and all of this, all these retrospectives, and then all of a sudden things just seem to happen in twos in Hollywood. It's like if there's one movie, there's going to be another movie that's almost exactly the same.
And
no strings attached and Friends with Benefits. They all have to come out the same.
Well, and also too, there's another very strange quirk that we'll talk about regarding this because of the casting, but it just kind of blew me away because I kind of got mixed up when the HBO movie The Girl came out. I thought that was the movie that everybody was anticipating about Hitchcock, but in the back of my mind I thought, but wasn't Sir Anthony Hopkins playing him?
Yes. Wasn't there a sir somewhere,
right? And here is it's Toby Jones, and I'm like, I got very confused. And then a week later, I got the invitation for the actual Hitchcock movie called Hitchcock.
So, yes, there are these two films. There is the theatrically released film called Hitchcock by Sasha Gervasi.
Very good.
Which is based on Stephen Rebello's Alfred Hitchcock and the Making of Psycho. That is the book that it is allegedly based on. I still have to read that book. I have not read the book.
You've done the research, though.
I have done the research. Oh, because I'm a Hitchcock scholar. I had to do the research.
Okay, very good.
And then the other film that's out is not a theatrical release. It is for TV. It's for cable. It's for HBO.
Right.
And it's still, I believe, available on demand. If it's not, it will be again.
Well, it's still running on HBO, by
It's still
the way.
Running on HBO.
The Girl.
And that is The Girl by Julian Gerald is the director. And it's based on Donald Spotto's book, which I have read, called Spellbound by Beauty, Alfred Hitchcock and His Leading Ladies. And the reason why I read that was because Spotto is my favorite Hitchcock historian. He was someone I think even Hitchcock himself held in a high regard as someone who is just a first-rate scholar and who's talked to the most people who've been actually involved in the film. So he's a fascinating writer.
Now, did you look to see what that director had done, the guy who did The Girl?
I haven't seen too much of his work.
I'd be interested to see what else he's done and the other director as well. Yeah. But anyway, barring that, yes. And so it got very confusing in the atmosphere. Suddenly there are two Hitchcock movies floating around, two portrayals of the master of suspense.
But this just gets me excited because I'm like, oh, great. Now we can finally see a movie that's based on one of my favorite directors. We can see a portrayal of his genius, of his craft, of what
the
he was like
workings.
On set, the person he was.
And what do we get?
We get two movies that are very, very, very little screen time is devoted to the actual craft and the actual genius. And most of it is devoted to the women in his life, the women who are the unsung heroes of the projects, the women that don't get enough credit, while Hitchcock comes off as kind of a hanger-on. Yeah, he's kind of a mama's boy in a way.
Well, let's bring that up first in The Girl, because you were talking about the behind-the-scenes look. Mm-hmm. In The Girl, we see one very famous scene from The Birds, where she's in the phone booth. And we see the setup and we see how it's done and everything, not to give anything away. But the point is they use it as a scene of torture for Tippi Hedren.
Tippi Hedren, the actress.
Instead of showing him at work, we show the fat, you know, stereotype man walking on the set, sitting in his seat, saying action, and suddenly this occurs and everybody's telling him, you can't do that to her.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, wait a minute. You know, there's a certain technique and a certain way to get things. How do we know this is true? Yeah. How do we know this is what happened behind the scenes?
Yes. I think you hit it on the head because it was a very one-note film.
Mm-hmm.
It just felt like every scene is Hitchcock is the predator. Hitchcock is the man obsessed with Tippi Hedren.
Yes.
Hitchcock is the man who's going to abuse her. And it just went on and on and on. And I felt like there might be a place for this just because this is allegedly what he was like on the set. And, you know, I have a tendency to believe it. I completely believe it because, you know, Spotto's interviews with Tippi Hedren have been available for a while. And I was aware of it for a while. But, I mean, it really is the most shocking chapter in the Spotto book about the Hitchcock-Hedren relationship. And really what he does is he traces through all of the relationships he's had with his actresses. And not romantic, but just the working relationships and that obsession that just kept consuming, till finally he found someone who wasn't a star, who was a victim, who could be victimized, who could be manipulated, and fit all of his, cool blonde,
And there is no denying that he took over her career and in the end kind of destroyed it. Mm-hmm. There's no denying that. However, I've interviewed Tippi Hedren 3 times. Have you ever interviewed her?
I got to talk to her briefly when she was in town for a screening of The Birds at the Music Box.
Okay.
And we'll get to that in a minute.
All right. So the challenge is always with her to try to come up. I have a rule with interview. I do not go into the past except in the second part of the interview because I want to warm them up with what they've been doing recently or as recent as possible when I'm talking to an old star. Mm-hmm. And once I warm them up, then I can hit them with the question that I've always wanted to ask.
Yeah.
But with Hedren, which was interesting, she is very willing to talk about the Birds. She's very willing to talk about her relationship with Hitchcock to a point where I wonder, I'm sure she was interviewed for The Making of the Girl, but it's to the point where I have to almost say to her, I'm sorry you've lived your life obsessing about this so much. At some point, you need to let it go and let your talent be your guide through the system.
So you feel a certain frustration?
I feel a certain blaming of Hitchcock for her own weaknesses as a performer. Like he directed her through The Birds, directed her through Marnie, 2 classics. But after that, he held her contract, which was Dirty Pool, and also blacklisted her, which is Dirty Pool.
Which, that means I can totally understand why she would want to support a film like this, why she'd want to support this thing anyway. I don't even know if she has a specific title in the credits. I know it's a special thanks, Tippi Hedren. She's in the featurettes about the film where she talks about it. So, I think she was very involved, and this is very much her perspective. Hitchcock is still enigmatic. Everyone else is enigmatic. It's really just about, poor me, I was the victim. But she was.
She was a victim. I'm not denying that. I'm simply saying.
And I feel like, yes, I can understand what you would say about, obsessing over it. But I feel like when you're in 2 classics like that, it's like society itself will never let you forget these. So it's like that you will just, she has to be reminded of it again and again.
Over and over again.
So it's a back and forth, I feel, in that sense. That was the main limitation of the film for me, was just that.
Well, let's face it, too. She had already been a model for 10 years. So she was in her late 20s by the time she was doing The Birds and Marnie. So then fast forward another 5 years, and suddenly you're in your late 30s. You get a chance to work with Charlie Chaplin on that Hong Kong Countess movie, his last movie.
Yeah.
But I think I get the feeling she just had a bit part there. I've never seen the film. Mm-hmm. But
she was in I Heart Huckabees. She's in a few things.
I mean, that's when she's older. I'm just saying the heart of her career was taken out of her. Mm-hmm. And I don't deny that for a second. But an actress of her stature, in a sense, the fact that she was not able to reignite her career had nothing to do with Hitchcock. Now, the downtrodden nature of going through an experience like that maybe would make you shy on the trigger. And I can understand that. Mm-hmm. And that you can blame.
We have to say to our listeners blatantly. I mean, what Spotto says in the book is that Hitchcock basically put his foot down and said, okay, you basically have to request sexual favors from you, or, you're basically done here. And that's when she said, I'm leaving. So, I mean, who could be? I mean, that's basically what Spotto's book says.
Which
and that's
is depicted
what's depicted
in The Girl.
In the film.
Yes.
Exactly. And I think that's a side of Hitchcock that you can't deny. I feel like in all of his work, and then we'll get into Psycho in a minute.
Right.
I think that's always been a factor in his work, is just this obsession, this self-loathing, this sort of the feeling of inadequacy and this desire. And I feel like that's what makes his work so fascinating. It was so personal and so unguarded. He probably didn't even realize. I feel like with the real great artists, their work is so honest that they don't even realize how much they're exposing themselves to people.
Well, again, when I was growing up in the 60s and 70s, Alfred Hitchcock was a cuddly teddy bear. He was a teddy bear.
Because that was the image he projected on the TV show.
Well, yeah, he was that uncle that comes and tells you a scary story, but he's you know, that voice and everything. You know, it's just like it to have him portrayed in these two movies as different from that is is more. This is definitely more humanizing, and humiliating at the same time, especially the way Toby Jones interprets it.
But getting to Cuddly Teddy Bear, we have to veer into Hitchcock. We have to veer into that one because that's a good way, a good segue into that.
Well, I just want to finish my point about the monster.
Yeah.
It's not the whole story to me. When I see the girl, I say, that's not the whole story. They're just telling the elements of the horror. Now, to me, sexual harassment is one of the most heinous things that you can do to another person, because not only is it physically invasive, but it's also psychologically damaging. Mm-hmm. And it can damage a person for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. And I think the girl is almost a lesson in that, in the sense that we see what happened to Tippi Hedren later. So let's move on to your next point.
I agree, and I'll just add to it that that's what makes her performance in Marnie, the film she did after The Birds and is also covered, so impressive to me, because she was a limited actress. She was a model. She wasn't an actress.
No.
And you could see her straining in The Birds. She's good in The Birds.
Yeah.
But Marnie is a hell of a performance under what she was going through.
Yes.
That is quite a performance. Okay.
All right.
Now, getting to Hitchcock.
Yes.
This is the cuddly Hitchcock. This is the cuddly Hitchcock. Ah. This is the palatable Hitchcock.
Yeah.
This is the commercially acceptable Hitchcock. This is the Hitchcock Patricia Hitchcock. I don't know if she's still around. I feel like she's still around. Mm-hmm. His daughter.
I would love to
see what she thinks of these two, but I feel like this is the one she would prefer, because this is a Hitchcock that we can say, okay, he had a little darkness, but he loved his wife and he was a nice guy. So that's basically what I've gleaned from this film.
Well, as I said, you and I expressed after we saw the movie that we wanted more behind the scenes psycho
stuff because
we had James D'Arcy there playing a dead perfect Anthony Perkins. It was like the man had come to life.
James D'Arcy is someone I've watched for a while.
Yeah.
And every time he's on screen, I'm like, he's the reincarnation of Anthony Perkins.
Did you see In Their Skin yet?
I haven't seen In Their Skin, but even in Cloud Atlas, in the Madonna film, W.E. I mean, I kept looking at his face, and he'd been up for this role for a while on IMDb saying he's going to play Anthony Perkins,
and I was like,
this is perfect.
It has to happen.
James D'Arcy shows up on the screen at the Critics Screening Room, I mean, half of his dialogue I couldn't even hear because people were laughing. They were just, and not laughing at him derisively, they're like, oh my gosh, he is perfect. He is so perfect.
It's almost one of the best scenes in the movie, just as a small little aside.
Yes.
And I like the theme that they were using. They were using, Hitchcock was going through the themes of, people who had the same tendencies as Norman.
Mm-hmm.
Like the screenwriter,
exactly,
and Anthony Perkins, and it was used to great comic effect.
And you know what? It's still not too late. I want them to reassemble that whole cast, and I want to see a whole feature length film about the making, because they got it right. They got it right with him, and they got it right with the guy that plays Joseph Stefano, who was the writer, Ralph Macchio of The Karate Kid, plays him, and he captures. I mean, everyone who's seen
this is Macchio's comeback, baby.
And I think he has like 3 or 4 lines.
I know,
in the movie.
But it's just, you never forget it.
No, because anyone who's seen a Stefano interview is like, that is his voice, that is his complexion.
I never have.
Well, I've seen so many documentaries on the making. There's so many great documentaries available on DVD of the making of Psycho.
Maybe you should recommend some.
I will.
Yeah, at the end of the show.
Sure. Well, I mean, Stefano is a fascinating character unto himself. And that was the main problem that I have. You know, in retrospect, I enjoyed Hitchcock as it went on. It's a heck of a lot more entertaining than The Girl.
Yes.
The Girl is dull. Hitchcock is fun.
Yes.
It gets his wit. It gets his dry wit. Hopkins is a hoot as Hitchcock. He's just so much fun to watch. But it just didn't get, once I got to step back from it, I was like, there's nothing really there in terms of his genius and who he was as a filmmaker.
Well, you know, and also, too, one of the reasons I thought it was fun is that it kind of delved into the times mm-hmm. times of movie making, where they mention Martin and Lewis, for example. It seems like Jerry's a whipping boy in this movie.
Yes.
But Cinderfella is coming out the same. Thank God we have Cinderfella.
Yes. Cinderfella is one of the biggest laughs.
And it has one of the great Chicago characters of all time, Barney Balaban, who built all those great theaters in Chicago, Balaban and Katz.
That's right.
And I couldn't believe he had a brief run as the president of Paramount, and it was during the making of Psycho.
Yeah.
Another thing they didn't that I like too regarding the production of Psycho is he uses television crew. Do you know that?
Yep.
That's why he was able to self-finance it for $800,000, which they never explain in the movie. They just say, oh, we got the money together. I'll write you a check.
And that's a huge downfall in the movie because that is one of the most fascinating aspects about the making of Psycho.
Yes.
And the fact that he went to, I just did a blog about this, about low-budget horror and how oftentimes the scariest films are the ones where the director limits himself in the budget or herself in the budget.
Yeah.
And that's what...
Jaws being the prime example.
Exactly. And that's what Hitchcock did here. And the very first shot, the Paramount logo is filmed as if it's through a TV screen.
Yes.
I mean, he's very upfront about that.
Yes.
So that is a key to why that's successful and why this film just reeks of that My Week with Marilyn biopics, sentimental, you know, I'm sorry.
Sentimental
simplification where it's like...
Mental
Flop. Well, it's because it's like we have to humanize them, but it's like we're dumbing down the actual details by saying Hitchcock mortgaged his house, which is a very debatable plot
That's
point.
That's very debatable.
It's a very debatable thing.
If he wasn't rich enough to get $800,000 together in 1960.
Yeah. So really, the huge downfall of this movie is the fact that they pushed so hard to make it a love story between Hitch and his wife, Alma Revel, who was a huge key.
Helen,
was a huge key collaborator.
Right.
But they basically make it sound like Alma directed the whole movie. That's
right.
basically
and,
what they
and
make
I,
it sound
and I,
like.
And I don't like the fact that Mirren, the way she plays her, I wasn't comfortable with that element of because we have Helen Mirren. Like, for example, Imelda Staunton
as Alma in The Girl
was much more accurate to me,
yes.
even though the movie was less than Mirren's performance, where she's in 80% of Hitchcock.
Yes. Whereas that was way too big of a role.
Staunton, and it was in the background.
Yes.
And but she looked like her.
Imelda Staunton is a dead ringer for Alma.
Is it Staunton or Staunton?
It's Staunton.
All right,
Staunton.
I said it first.
I got it for you.
Let me put that on the record, folks. I said Staunton first. All right.
But I mean, she's a dead ringer for Alma, and she's the kind of person I think Alma actually was like. So the thing is, Hitchcock may be a more entertaining film, but The Girl is probably a more accurate film. I hate to say it, The Girl's more accurate.
In conclusion, you are absolutely right. Yeah. Going back to Psycho, I wanted to make one more point. It is one of the films that has made the most money in comparison to the budget it had.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the film that broke that record?
Paranormal Activity, right?
Well,
I'm just kidding. But it's like that's an extreme.
Well, probably Blair Witch Project would be in there, but Deep Throat.
Oh, okay. Sure. Yeah.
They believe that Deep Throat, which had about a $5,000 budget, they believe the Deep Throat, they can't get the accurate box office on it, but they think it is cleared about 60 to 100 million.
So that's like
and
the most profitable film.
Well, profitable vis-a-vis its production budget.
Sure, sure.
So, but at the time, Psycho was the king because he made $800,000 and it made multiple, for the time, probably made 30 million, let's say.
And they get into that a little bit at the end, how brilliant the marketing was.
Right.
How this was the first film people had to show up on time to see.
Right.
I mean, there was just such genius in the way that he went about it. But the filmmakers, the script just makes it so much about, well, Alma came up with that. Alma Alma said you have to get Anthony Perkins. Alma said Bernard Herrmann score has to be in there. It just got too much where it's like, yes, Alma was a key collaborator, but they're just making it so much about her, it just got annoying after
a
while.
So let's talk about the comparative performances of the Hitchcocks.
Let's do that.
And before we put that on the table, I just want to say this is one of the most, I believe, one of the most amazing movie facts, even though the HBO is a made-for-TV, that the same year that Capote was made, the movie Infamous was made. And who played the other Capote? Toby Jones.
That's right. Philip Seymour Hoffman gets the Oscar.
Yes,
he gets the glory.
Right.
And he gets the more theatrical, of a release.
And Infamous plays about five theaters.
Toby Jones plays the exact same role in Infamous and is just completely forgotten about.
And I will say that they both did a stellar job with it. And I'm not going to compare those performances because they were top drawer. I will compare these two performances of the Hitchcocks. So we got that out of the way about Toby Jones. Toby Jones is given a much rougher assignment to play Hitchcock. He had to play him as a monster.
And with all the wit stripped away. I mean, he's such a loathsome person. You're like, how could anyone even bear to be with this man?
The constant repetition of his limericks that are so vaingloriously dirty.
All vulgar, all unfunny.
Oh.
And yes, I believe Hitchcock did that, but I feel like people kind of laughed off some of the jokes. I mean, I've seen different accounts of actors saying that, so I feel like that's true.
But I think he had more of a natural wit, too,
exactly.
Where he didn't have to rely so much on dick jokes.
That he's just a vulgarian, and he's just someone who's he's just like a teen in a locker room sort of
but
guy.
But given that he had that assignment, I think he comported himself with he's such a fine actor. I think Toby Jones is a very fine actor. He comported himself with the best he could give something like that. But again, the way the character was written, he unfortunately had to deal with that as well.
Yeah. I think it's a great performance, actually, trapped in a very, very flawed film.
I think it's a great performance.
I think he gives the most incredible Hitchcock voice I've ever heard in my life. I actually played him and Hopkins back to back because I just wanted to compare. And he just nails the voice.
You hear too much of Anthony Hopkins in the imitation that he's doing.
You do. Yeah. You do.
Which he did in Nixon, too, which is fine.
Exactly.
So
because he knows that he's an institution anyway. So it's like, if I'm going to play an icon, you're going to get a little bit of my own natural icon, you know, quotient in there.
And then they both wear costumes, okay? They both wear the Hitchcock costume.
Like when he refused to do the Southern accent and all the King's Men. Like, he's just that kind of guy. It's like, I'm just doing it, you know.
So they both are in costume, and it seems like I believe that Jones actually feels a little more comfortable in the costume than Hopkins because he's Anthony Hopkins. Mm-hmm. But maybe this is just my perception of it. I think I mentioned this to you after we saw the movie. I would occasionally see a peek of Anthony Hopkins from the costume, like a head pops out, and suddenly it's Anthony, and then it recedes back into the character.
The big fleshy neck that his head has to sit on top of. Yeah,
the big fleshy neck.
But the thing that I love, my next album title, Big Fleshy Neck.
Exactly.
Well, the thing that I love about Hopkins is that he's allowed to be witty, and he does nail the Hitchcock wit and the dryness of the wit.
Yes, he does.
And there's some wonderful scenes.
Right.
There's some wonderful shots where he's just talking at the camera, and he's doing like the Alfred Hitchcock Presents, you know, like reading off the cue cards blatantly thing, and he just does it great. So I thought that was a great decision. Yeah.
And also to bring in the origin of Psycho was a great decision. And also
with Ed Gein, and also
to see Hitchcock backstage while one of his movies is playing. Was a great decision.
It was a great decision. But I want to talk about Ed Gein for a second because that was a surprise that he was even in
there. Well, you're going to put this podcast out after the movie.
After the movie's out.
Yes.
But I felt that out. Even though I enjoy the fact that he's in there in a cameo, I feel like he's way overused and way too much trying to.
I didn't like that.
You know, at one point we have Hitchcock sitting on a therapist's bed listening to Ed Gein like take down his notes. I'm like, this is ridiculous. I mean, it's such an easy, superficial way to say, oh, Hitchcock had a darkness about him. But like, what kind of darkness? Then you see him talk about he has all the actress, you know, pictures out, and he's like, "Oh, I have these impulses." But what impulse? Like, it never pushes the real darkness.
No.
And the biggest flaw in that thing is the recreation of the shower scene, which is one of the only scenes you see in the film that's an actual recreation of a scene from Psycho.
Yes.
And Hitchcock's like,
they show the car driving scene.
I'm saying one of the very few.
All right, all right.
I mean, you don't get to
see nothing with Perkins, nothing
with Norman Bates. What a
joke. He did get to dress up in the suit and walk around his office, but.
Yeah.
But let's talk about.
I want to say the shower scene is they have Hitchcock ripping open the shower curtain and stabbing all of the sensors that I can't release this, and this is the worst thing about the whole movie is the subplot with Alma and this guy that she's lusting after. And so basically what they're saying is Hitchcock was all angry when he's making Psycho because he thought his wife is having an affair, which is just such a blatant lie. And it misses the point of what makes the shower scene so unsettling.
It was set up for Murren's part. Yeah. Not have anything to do with the biography, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I think at that point they would have been married, 30, 40 years, whatever, let's say 30 years. Mm-hmm. I don't think if she was collaborating with someone, even if they were doing something on the side, that quite frankly he would care.
I mean, here are two examples of Hitchcock's really disturbing dark genius, okay? For me, the shower scene is essentially a metaphor for a rape scene.
Yes.
That's what makes it so horrible and violating and what made it so shocking at the time. And it was essentially a precursor for the wedding rape in Marnie that he pushed for and pushed for. And that was really his own darkness coming out and his own. So
you get an aspect of pansexuality where a person is not sexual, but they want to create a sexual situation that is not normal.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there is still a great film yet to be made about the Hitchcock-Alma relationship, but it has to be much darker.
Maybe you will make that
film. I know, maybe
film.
I will, because essentially Mother Bates is Alma. She is the mother figure in his life, and he's always lusting after the blonde that she must destroy. So that is really, to me, what Psycho is about.
And you make a good point there, because I will say, too, that we talked about this briefly, but how many filmmakers have had their psychosis so blatantly portrayed and analyzed? Not only portrayed, but analyzed. You know, once we see it, we go, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. And suddenly we have five books that'll tell you what it means. But that's kind of the genius of the filmmaker who got the opportunity, like Hitchcock, to have a career that starts in the silent era and goes all the way up to where he could show the blood, he could show the nudity.
Mm-hmm. And frenzy the nudity, as
right,
all blatant.
Right.
You know.
So let's go. I want to quickly, before we wrap this up, compare the girls.
Yes.
Sienna Miller and Scarlett Johansson.
Scarlett Johansson plays Janet Leigh. I'm actually right in the middle of reading Janet Leigh's memoir on Psycho, which is a lot of fun, a very good book.
Okay.
And I feel like Scarlett Johansson's portrayal is probably the most convincing aspect of the film, because I feel like she had a very warm, you know, view of Hitchcock. I mean, maybe a bit unsettled, a bit critical, but, you know, she was just so happy to be there. And I feel like, you know, she was also, like, off limits. And I think she even says in the memoir, like, maybe the reason he wasn't so weird around me is, you know, I was married, I was a star. You know, it's like, whereas someone like Tippi Hedren was much more vulnerable.
She was single, and she wasn't a star.
Mm-hmm,
so, but I thought Johansson was fabulous.
She is. This is something she's good
at. She lights up the screen. Yeah, yeah. She lights up the screen in this. She had the inflection of Janet Leigh's voice. Again, not doing an imitation, but just that I don't know what part of the country Janet Leigh is from, but she had whatever the accent is from whatever part of the country she came from. She had stone cold. And just that, those two elements, she didn't look at anything like her.
No, but she had enough of a triangular face in the hair, because that's what Janet Leigh's face is to me, is like an upside down triangle. And so it was just enough there. So
and then we go to Sienna Miller as Tippi Hedren. Well, one thing I will say, and again, having interviewed Tippi Hedren three times, there is only one Tippi Hedren. There is no one can duplicate her.
No.
I think Miller and the production staff made a decision to let Miller be Miller. Let's not try to create a Tippi Hedren. Let's just let her represent her. Mm-hmm. What's your opinion on that?
I don't think
she did a good job either. Let me point that out.
Miller did?
Yeah, I didn't think that she... I thought she was kind of sitting there, you know. But, again, she was the victim, so go ahead.
Yeah, and see, that's what I have to see. Is this the performance that's being stagnant, or is it the script that's allowing her to be... I felt like it was an empathetic performance. I felt like she had clearly talked to Hedren and was trying to sort of dutifully, you know, portray all of that. But, I mean, she has nothing to do. She has nothing to do except take it until she walks away. And that's just... And there's nothing there. There's nothing
there
cinematic
is no
about
depth,
there.
Yeah.
There's nothing dramatic about
there's
that.
There's no depth of character either, so...
Yeah.
Well, very interesting discussion.
And this is the last thing I'll say, too.
Yes.
If you want to talk about Hitchcock and all the missed opportunities in that film, is they talk about a little bit about the toilet in Psycho.
Yes.
The fact that it was the first time you could see a toilet in like a mainstream film. And that was another way Hitchcock just wanted to sort of make audiences uncomfortable and just show that. But what they don't get into in the film, and I wish they got into some semblance of his genius, was why he had that toilet in there and the symbolism of it. And how it's basically, you know, he says, well, that's where, you know, the clue is you put the paper in there and it's going to come back up. And
it's
the things you want to flush, but come back up.
Right.
And just think of the symbol there with the bog and sinking the car and the things that could come up. I mean, so much and everything going down the drain. There's such genius in that film that these films ignore.
And that's why I did like the scene with the editing process, because suddenly those are the times when suddenly the elements that you're putting in are suddenly coming together. They sort of seem to relate to each other. You know, as an editor, and I've done enough editing to know that you will take two disparaging elements, you'll put them together, and suddenly they fit.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you'd planned it. And I think that scene in Hitchcock, you'll see it, where they're editing the picture, you will get a sense of how those things come together.
Yes.
Subconsciously.
And that's when it gets exciting. And that's when those moments are so good in Hitchcock that I left feeling like I liked it, but they just got more and more sour. But it shows the potential for what a filmmaker can do when he's really exploring Hitchcock's craft and Hitchcock's process.
Another
so that's the
brilliant
next,
conversation.
That's the film that we'll be looking
another
forward to.
Another brilliant conversation. And again, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming here,
this
Pat.
This is brilliant. Thank you.
And for all of our recent reviews and interviews, check out HollywoodChicago.com. And for my independent coverage, check out Indie-Outlook.com.
Please check it out.
That concludes today's episode of Indie Outlook. I'm your host, Matt Fagerholm, and I invite you to tune in next time for more coverage of the latest and greatest in modern independent cinema. Till then, I'll be on the lookout.